You're listening to Veracity Radio. Last, we'll be listening to a hearing from December 10, 2007, with the U.S. Helsinki Commission on waterboarding and torture in U.S. custody. This segment is from C-SPAN coverage, and we thank them for their work to cover these kinds of events. Make sure you visit them at cspan.org.
Techniques, including the practice of waterboarding. The U.S. Helsinki Commission, a government agency that monitors international human rights, hosts this hour and 40-minute event.
Thank you all for coming. I would just say there are many seats in the front, and it would be would help the commission if we could fill in some of the seats in the front. For those of you who are looking for a seat, makes it easier to have a dialogue, I think, between the people at the podium and the audience. I really welcome you all to this hearing on torture and other forms of banned treatment being called by the U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, also known as the U.S. Helsinki Commission. I'd like to thank Congressman Hastings, the chairman of the commission, and Senator Cardin, vice chairman, for calling this hearing and coming to Maryland. And I thank all of the witnesses for providing their expertise to these proceedings. The university is extremely honored to be hosting this hearing today. We are engaged in many initiatives on human rights parallel to the aims of the U.S. Helsinki Commission. Over the last 6 years, the issues of torture and banned treatment have understandably provoked intense national debate. Hearings like this one afford free and open discussions of this deeply troubling and potentially culture-changing matter. I applaud the Commission for its relentless attention to these issues. I particularly want to offer my personal welcome to Senator Cardin, who has always been a staunch supporter of the university. Thank you very much, Senator. Senator Cardin has served on the U.S. Helsinki Commission since 1993. Most recently, he has been outspoken about the impact of the U.S. Guantanamo Bay prison on U.S. human rights leadership internationally as well as at home. Congressman L.C.L. Hastings has served on the commission since 2001. A senior Democratic whip from Florida, Congressman Hastings is a specialist on international affairs and has been active in election monitoring in Eastern Europe. I thank you both for your leadership efforts on behalf of the Helsinki Commission and on human rights and democratic values.
Dr. Moe, thank you very much, Mr. President, all for being with us this morning. And I also understand with an active schedule with 40,000 plus students in finals week that you doubtless have other responsibilities. So when you take your leave, it's with deep appreciation that we are grateful for you to be here. I'm going to gavel a hearing into session at this time and turn immediately to my colleague, co-chairman Cardin, and for any opening remarks. And with your permission, Senator, I'd like for you then to go forward and conduct the hearing. I do have an opening statement, if you would permit, after yours, sir.
First, Dr. Moe, thank you very much for allowing us to use the University of Maryland College Park. This is, I think, the right venue for this hearing, and we thank you very much. We're very proud of our University of Maryland College Park, what you do here. This campus has been in the forefront leadership nationally on education issues. This Congress will be known for several things, but one, of course, is passing this most significant increase in college assistance from the federal government, student aid, since the GI Bill. So it's a pleasure to be back on campus. It's always nice to be here and always nice to see the students and just the activity that occurs on campus. Congratulations. And to Chairman Hastings, I want to thank him very much for convening this hearing in College Park on torture. Chairman Hastings has had a long and distinguished career in the United States Congress. And let me just pause for one moment, if I might, talk a little bit about the Helsinki Commission. In 1975, the countries of Europe, the United States, and Canada, and Helsinki entered into certain fundamental basic principles in which they agreed to adhere to. On human rights, on security, on economic and environmental issues. And by entering into that agreement, it was legitimate for any country that was part of the Helsinki process to challenge the practices in any other state if they don't meet those commitments. The United States Congress passed a law establishing the Helsinki Commission as our membership in the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is the umbrella for monitoring and carrying out the commitments entered into in Helsinki. The commission consists of 9 members of the United States Senate, 9 members of the United States House of Representatives, and certain appointments by the executive branch. We rotate the chairmanship every 2 years. And Alcee Hastings, the congressman from Florida, who's joined us here today, is the chairman of the commission. The Senate has the co-chairmanship, and Leader Reid appointed me as the co-chairman of the Helsinki Commission. But Chairman Hastings has done a lot more than just the Helsinki Commission. We also have what's known as a parliamentary assembly, which is where parliamentarians from the member states, now totaling 57, meet and carry out our responsibility as parliamentarians. And Alcee Hastings, I think, really established history for us in the United States by becoming president of that parliamentary assembly, the first American to chair it, and really did carry out an incredibly active schedule as the president of the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly. So this commission tries to establish priorities for our involvement in the OSCE. We challenge what other states do in the OSCE. We've been very actively involved with the former Soviet Union in dealing with the emigration of its population. We dealt with problems in Chechnya. We've dealt with problems of the Kurdish population in Turkey and in Europe. We have brought forward many different issues, most recently the trafficking of human beings, as well as anti-Semitism and all forms of discrimination. But as it is right for us to challenge what other countries are doing, our commission also has a responsibility to look at whether our nation is carrying out the commitments that we agreed to within the Helsinki framework. And today's hearing is to take a look at that. This is not our first hearing. Under Chairman Hastings, we've had a hearing on Guantanamo Bay as to whether we are complying with international standards and our own commitments as it relates to the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. But today's hearing is to take a look at torture. It's interesting that we are convening this hearing on this day, which is International Human Rights Day, a day which commemorates the adoption of the Universal Declarations on Human Rights nearly 60 years ago. It stated in that historic document, "No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment." Now, since that, the United States has adopted many international commitments as it relates to humane treatment. In 1949, the Geneva Convention, the 1966 International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and of course the 1984 Convention Against Torture, all of which we have agreed to. Through the Helsinki process, we have entered into numerous commitments as it relates to torture, and we've made that available in the information that is available at our desk. But let me just refer to one, if I might, the Vienna concluding document in 1989, where we agreed to ensure that all individuals in detention or incarceration will be treated with humanity and with respect for inherent dignity of the human person. There are no exceptions or no loopholes in this standard, in which is the obligation of the United States to uphold. So I think it's pretty clear what our international commitments are and what our domestic laws. I deeply regret that 6 decades after the adoption of the international human rights commitments, it is necessary to have a hearing on torture. And more to the point, I regret that the United States' own policies and practices must be the focus of our consideration. Since we scheduled this hearing, of course, has now been the revelation of the destruction of tapes by the CIA, which I think raises additional questions as to the United States' commitment in carrying out its responsibilities. As a member of the Helsinki Commission, I have long been concerned about the persistence of torture and other forms of abuse in the OSCE region. For example, I was troubled by the pattern of torture in Uzbekistan, a country in which the United States has extradited terror suspects. In November alone, Radio Free Europe reported that two individuals died. We now have learned that a third individual has died in Uzbekistan. And when we have looked at their bodies, we find many marks of torture. Unfortunately, United States leadership in the effort to combat torture and other forms of ill treatment have been undermined by the revelations of abuse at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. As horrific as Abu Ghraib revelations were, in a certain respect, the government's legal memos on torture may even be more damaging, since they appear to reflect a policy to condone torture and immunize those who have committed torture. In fact, when Secretary of State Rice met with leading human rights activists in Moscow in October, they told her that allegations of abuse of U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq has hurt Washington's authority on human rights. Torture remains a serious problem in a number of OSCE countries, particularly in the Russian region of Chechnya. But if the United States is to address those issues credibly, we must get our own house in order. In this regard, I was deeply disappointed by the unwillingness of Attorney General Mukasey to state clearly and unequivocally that waterboarding is torture. As a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I chaired part of Attorney General's confirmation hearings, and I found the responses to the questions relating to torture woefully inadequate. As it happens, on November 14th, I also participated in another Judiciary Committee hearing in which an El Salvadorian torture survivor testified. This medical doctor, who can no longer practice surgery because of the torture inflicted upon him, wanted to make one thing very clear. As someone who had been the victim of what the torturers called the bucket treatment, said waterboarding is torture. Earlier this year, from the former Bush administration's counselor, Philip Zelikow, argued that whether legal or not, the interrogation policies developed in 2002 were just flat immoral. He goes on to talk about how it is just inconceivable that we allow those types of principles, offering no judgment on their legality. Well, we have a lot of authority as to U.S. laws on torture. He added, sliding into habits of growing non-cooperation and alienation is not just a problem of world opinion. It will eventually interfere very concretely with the conduct of worldwide operations. Well, at today's hearings, we're going to hear from many witnesses who will comment about the different practices of the United States and the impact it is having on our own country's ability to affect international policy. I really do thank our witnesses for being here. I know they're going to add greatly to our record, which is the responsibility we have, not just to the other members of the United States Congress, but to the American people. And I'm sure that this hearing will play a very important part in the development of that record for our commission and our country. It's now my pleasure to introduce again Congressman Hastings for his opening comments.
Thank you very much, Senator Cardin. I deeply appreciate your convening this field hearing. It's our first field hearing, and I also would like to express my appreciation to President Moat and to Ray Kratt and the tremendous interaction of staffs, both those at the University of Maryland and the campus police and security for expediting matters for us. It's deeply appreciated. We consider it so professional. And we have space issues at the Capitol, and we were wondering, President Moat, if we could hold more hearings here, it would probably be helpful to us. But I'd like to compliment our staff as well for coming up with how we are able to get this done. And while I'm in that business, my deep appreciation to those media representatives that are here, as well as those of you that are students and professors and visitors here on the campus, particularly those of you that are students. I attended a forum once 100 years ago when I was in college, and it was during finals week. Fortunately for me, I had completed my finals, and I hope all of you either are complete or assured. Let me put it that way. But we're grateful for you being here. This hearing, as the Senator points out, comes just a few days after the revelations about the destruction of videotapes by the CIA of the interrogation of two terror suspects. As the Senator has said, and I wish to amplify, the destruction of these tapes is disturbing on many levels, but especially when one considers that the 911 Commission and many of the persons on that commission are people that Senator Cardin and I served in Congress with and or know through our professional relationships. And I don't think that anyone has questioned this commission's credibility and integrity. And that said, they specifically and formally sought these types of recordings and were not given them. And I can't imagine why, when the 911 Commission was investigating one of the worst attacks on American soil in the history of our country, why the CIA did not fully cooperate with that investigation. Like you, Senator Cardin, I'm profoundly frustrated by the damage that has been done to America's good name and credibility by the documented instances of abuse that have occurred in the context of our country's effort to combat terrorism, and by the erosion of the legal principles which make torture and other forms of ill treatment a crime. I was speaking earlier with one of our professors that is going to testify, Dr. Hilde, who is here at the university. And a part of his portfolio is in philosophy. I cited to him a friend of mine that teaches philosophy at another university, but I didn't say to him something that I did, and that is I co-taught a class on the trial by Kafka. And it always comes to mind to me when I think of Guantanamo as a for example of holding people, not telling them what they're charged with, not allowing them access to lawyers, and in some instances threatening them with potential execution without knowing what it's all about. I just don't think that's America. And I think it's wrong. Many people have said it, but it seems to me to deserve repeating. And I put this in the context as someone who has visited more intelligence stations than probably any other current member of Congress. Torture does not, in my opinion, make us any safer. And torture, in my opinion, does not produce good intelligence. In fact, there have been several notorious instances of detainees providing testimony under duress that has subsequently been shown to be false. And some of the evidence, for example, relied upon by Secretary Powell in his 2003 speech to the United Nations making the case for war in Iraq came from a detainee who later recanted that testimony and stated that he made his claim as a result of coercive interrogation. I'm going to skip large portions because you'll be more interested in the witnesses, but I would be remiss if I didn't point to, as we examine this subject today and hear our witnesses, I'd also hope that the administration will begin to devote some serious attention and resources to study better ways to gain intelligence. Too often, intelligence gathering and respect for human rights are presented as a zero-sum game, where more of one means less of another. I think that is a false paradigm. There's more we can be doing to improve our intelligence gathering that does not have to come at the expense of human rights. For example, we could stop kicking people out of the military who have critically needed foreign language skills just because they're gay. We can provide more training for critical languages. We can study non-coercive interrogation methods, something we have not done since World War II. None of those things involve or require torture. Finally, Senator Cardin, I'd like to express my immense disappointment, to say the least, to hear that President Bush is prepared to veto the 2008 fiscal year intelligence authorization bill because it would require the Central Intelligence Agency to follow the same interrogation norms that apply to military personnel. As it now stands, the 2006 Detainee Treatment Act prohibits military personnel from engaging in torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment of detainees. Last February, Jeffrey Smith, the former general counsel to the CIA, argued strongly in the pages of the Washington Post that armed services and the CIA should not have different standards for the treatment and interrogation of detainees. And I think he's right. So I truly hope that the intelligence authorization bill will be passed, including its provision regarding CIA interrogation's norms, and I hope that the President will expeditiously sign it into law. Senator, thank you again for your thoughtful and long-standing leadership on this issue. I had the distinct pleasure of serving with Senator Cardin in the House of Representatives and working with him in the organizations that he described over a period of time. And I personally am proud, and I know you as Marylanders are, of the extraordinary work that he has done, not only in this area, but on behalf of this university, as well as this state that he proudly represents. I'm proud to be with you today at your state's flagship university. I hope all of us get better football teams next year and to explore these issues, and both right here at home and across the globe. Thank you, Senator.
Well, thank you, Chairman Hastings. I need to acknowledge, I think both of us would want the record to reflect that when we're in College Park, Maryland, the extraordinary help our mentor, Steny Hoyer, has been on the Helsinki Commission and the OSCE. He, of course, was a former chair and I think really brought the Commission's work to the forefront in the United States Congress, good friends of both of ours, and a real Terp supporter. There's no stronger cheerleader for the Terps than Congressman Hoyer. With that, we're going to turn to our witnesses. Our first would be Mrs. Devin Chafee, who's an attorney with the Human Rights First and was a contributing author of the publication jointly issued with Physicians for Human Rights, Leave No Marks, Enhanced Interrogation Techniques, and the Risk of Criminality. At the invitation of the Department of Defense, Ms. Chafee has also served as Human Rights First Official Observer at the Military Commission held at the United States Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Ms. Chafee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I applaud the committee for holding this hearing. This morning, I hope to help bring clarity to an area where the administration officials have fabricated ambiguity, U.S. law prohibiting torture and other cruel treatment. The administration has repeatedly refused to take off the table interrogation techniques that are obviously and inherently cruel. It has established a dangerous bifurcated approach to detainee treatment standards, creating an exception for the CIA to engage in interrogation methods that the military has repeatedly found to be unlawful. In July, the President issued an executive order that lays out an interpretation of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions for the CIA that is different from the standard used by the military. Common Article 3 lays out the minimum standard for treatment for enemy prisoners. Shortly after the issuance of the executive order, the Director of National Intelligence, Admiral Michael McConnell, and former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez publicly refused to state whether the executive order prohibited specific acts of cruelty for use by the intelligence community. The Judge Advocates General of the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps, on the other hand, had no trouble answering unequivocally in August 2006 that the use of waterboarding, stress positions, the use of dogs, and removal of clothing in interrogation would not only be humane, but would violate U.S. law and the law of war. The administration's official position of ambiguity on CIA interrogation standards became a central issue during the recent confirmation of Attorney General Michael Mukasey. Then Judge Mukasey refused to answer questions on whether waterboarding was illegal, claiming that it depended on a complex legal analysis upon which he was unable to speculate. But as four retired generals and admirals said in a letter to Senator Leahy, the relevant rule, the law, has long been clear. Waterboarding detainees amounts to illegal torture in all circumstances. To suggest otherwise, or to even give credence to such a suggestion, represents both an affront to the law and to the core values of our nation. Yet some senators legitimized Judge Mukasey's equivocation by calling on Congress to outlaw waterboarding. Co-Chairman Cardin, you pointed out the absurdity of suggesting that Congress had somehow forgotten to outlaw waterboarding when you asked whether that meant we would have to pass a statute that explicitly outlaws the use of rack or thumbscrews. What Attorney General Mukasey and the administration have obscured is the fact that Congress has already outlawed torture and other acts of cruelty. The McCain Amendment, the Anti-Torture Act, the War Crimes Act, and Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions establish clear standards for the treatment of all prisoners in U.S. custody. Under these laws, an act is specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering is torture. An act intended to inflict severe or serious physical or mental pain or suffering is a felony war crime of cruel or inhumane treatment. The Detainee Treatment Act requires that no person in the custody or physical control of the United States shall be subjected to torture or cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment prohibited by the 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendments. Common Article 3 additionally prohibits outrages upon human dignity. Existing statutory language under a reasonable interpretation prohibits the use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques that have reportedly been authorized for use by the CIA. The most detailed public account of the enhanced interrogation techniques was published in a November 8, 2005 ABC News report. The report, which has been widely cited as credible, described the authorization of violent shaking, striking prisoners, stress positions, use of extreme cold, sleep deprivation, and waterboarding. In June 2007, Human Rights First and Physicians for Human Rights published the first comprehensive evaluation of the nature and extent of harm likely to result from enhanced interrogation techniques and the legal risks faced by interrogators who employ them. As a principal co-author of the report titled Leave Low Marks, I can tell you our findings were clear. The recent revelation of the CIA's destruction of videotapes of interrogations in which some of these methods were inflicted on prisoners indicates that at least some in the administration understood what we know, that these techniques are unlawful because they cause serious physical and psychological harm to the individuals against which they are used. We know that the United States has condemned the use of such cruel methods by brutal regimes in the past. The techniques are illegal and should clearly be taken off the table for all U.S. interrogators. I want to share a sample of the report's findings on three of the reportedly authorized so-called enhanced techniques: long-time standing, sleep deprivation, and waterboarding. Long-time standing is a painful, life-threatening stress position that has long been considered a form of torture. It is known to cause blood clots, which can travel to the lungs as potentially fatal pulmonary embolisms. If continued long enough, it can lead to nerve damage. The State Department has criticized some of the world's most repressive states, including Burma, Iran, and Libya, for employing long-time standing in interrogations. The United Kingdom and Israel abandoned as illegal similar stress positions, such as wall standing and forcing a prisoner to stand on the tips of his toes. After World War II, U.S. military commissions prosecuted Japanese troops for employing such stress positions on American prisoners. The U.S. Supreme Court has condemned the obvious cruelty of leaving a prisoner in the sun in a standing stress position, calling it degrading, dangerous, and antithetical to human dignity. Sleep deprivation is also a classic form of torture. It is one of the most efficient means of inflicting mental pain, and medical studies have established a relationship between sleep deprivation and psychiatric disorders such as major depression. 6 decades ago, the U.S. Supreme Court cited with approval an American Bar Association report that made the following observation. It has been known since 1500 at least that the deprivation of sleep is the most effective torture and certain to produce any confession desired. In recent years, the U.S. State Department has condemned Indonesia, Iran, Jordan, Libya, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey for using sleep deprivation as a form of torture or cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. Finally, waterboarding creates the sense that a person is drowning and is facing imminent death by strapping the individual down and pouring water over the face. Medical complications from the asphyxiation caused by waterboarding include acute or chronic respiratory problems, chronic pain in the back and head, panic attacks, depressive symptoms, and prolonged post-traumatic stress disorder. Waterboarding was used extensively during the Spanish Inquisition and has been used by the most brutal regimes in the world, including the Khmer Rouge and the military junta in Argentina, and was prosecuted repeatedly after World War II as a war crime. Congress must act now to ensure that the CIA does not engage in these types of cruel techniques that clearly violate U.S. law by passing a provision that would hold the intelligence community to the same standard we hold the military to. Currently, detainees in the custody of the Department of Defense may only be subjected to interrogation techniques approved in the Army Field Manual. Military interrogators with over 20 years of field experience have testified that the Army Field Manual allows for nuanced and sophisticated interrogations that elicit the necessary information. General Petraeus specifically stated in a letter to the troops in May that military experience shows that the techniques in the manual work effectively and humanely in eliciting information from detainees. It is the military that faces real ticking time bombs every day in the form of improvised explosive devices. It is also the military that relies upon Common Article 3 when its personnel are taken into enemy custody. The Intelligence Authorization Act, reported out of conference last week, includes a provision that would prohibit the use of any interrogation technique not approved in the Army Field Manual against detainees in the custody of the intelligence community. The conference report stated that the provision reflects the conferees' considered judgment that the CIA's program is not the most effective method of obtaining the reliable intelligence we need to protect the United States from attack, and that the conferees concluded that the damage to the international perception of the United States by the existence of classified interrogation procedures that apply only to the CIA program outweighs the intelligence benefits. The report also recognized that as the primary beneficiaries of the protections of the Geneva Conventions, the U.S. military should play an important role in ensuring that U.S. interrogation policy complies with those international protections. It is past time to resolve the ambiguity created by the CIA's secret interrogation program. Congress should swiftly pass this provision and legislate one standard of humane treatment for all U.S. interrogations. The world no longer knows what the United States means when it says we do not torture and that we treat prisoners humanely. That is a dangerous situation for our troops, and it has a devastating impact on U.S. morale, moral authority, and standing in the world. We look to you and your colleagues, Mr. Chairman, to put that right. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Without objection, all of your testimonies, all the witnesses, will be made part of our record. I'll now call, and we'll hold the questioning until we've completed all of the witnesses on the panel. Dr. Thomas Hilde is a professor at the School of Public Policy here at the University of Maryland. He's editor of a forthcoming book on torture. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to speak here in front of the Helsinki Commission. As mentioned, I'm an ethicist and social and political philosopher, soon to publish a book on torture, and I've been asked to speak about some of the moral ramifications of torture. Historically, physical and psychological torture has been used to suppress dissent, force renunciation of beliefs, extract confessions, punish, force denunciation of others, intimidate a population, humiliate people, and gather information. All torturers claim a state of necessity. Recently, some have advanced the claim of significant information, once again, to justify torture. They argue that the information gained from torture is of greater moral significance than the torture of individual human beings. As with most ethical issues, how the problem is articulated is of crucial importance. Today, torture is commonly justified by a state of necessity, emblematic in the proverbial ticking time bomb, which frames the issue wrongly from the outset and grounds it in a state of fear. A better understanding of what is entailed in seeking morally significant information through torture belies the justification. Torture works in that torture victims speak, although the information is notoriously unreliable, as noted since the time of Aristotle. Accounts of torture from the Inquisitions exhibit the most delirious and fantastic tales from the victims. This information served to confirm the prior beliefs of the torturers. Bad weather, for instance, was thought to be caused by airborne demons in consort with human witches. Torture victims confirmed these beliefs, providing the preposterous prior beliefs and the inquisitor's authority. If information must be of great moral significance to justify torture, how would we know it was of such significance? First, torturing for information requires the institutionalization of torture. There must be trained torturers and thus also trainers, a legal and administrative apparatus, a cadre of doctors and lawyers and data analysts, and so on, all of whom would be required to suspend their moral decency. Second, since raw information from an individual torture victim is unreliable, morally significant information is unlikely to be gained from an individual victim alone. Torture must be used broadly. On occasion, the torturers might have prior expectations that the prisoner indeed possesses important information. But this may obviate any perceived need to torture. The justification of morally significant information demands prior knowledge that the torture victim possesses this information. More likely than the time bomb case of torturing one bad person is the case of torturing many innocent people in search of what might justify the act of torture. How does one know when one has true information? What one does when one seeks to justify torture by gaining important information is presuppose that such information exists, which will only be discovered through a morally heinous practice. The information must thus be previously unknown in order to justify using torture. Yet, its moral significance must also be previously known in order to justify the act. It's not meaningful information until one has tortured, gained information, and then verified it. This is where information may become meaningful, but it's not necessarily true, as noted in the account of the Inquisition. The victim's guilt need never be resolved. One incentive raised by the argument for torture as a means of gathering information is to seek patterns of information rather than attempt to verify or falsify individual bits of data. Comprehensive sets of data points yield more complex patterns. The more extensive the institution, the more successful torture will be. If one tortures indiscriminately and broadly, one thus obtains more complex patterns and a better understanding of what is meaningful in the information. Patterns of information by themselves are meaningless, but they serve to corroborate and verify bits of information and infer other patterns. A descriptive narrative may be interpreted and assembled from the resulting patterns and regularities. At no point has meaningful information risen to the level of morally significant information that could justify torture in the time bomb scenario. We end up with a swelling institution in search of its moral justification, causing increasing damage to innocents and ourselves, all in search of the supreme moral justification, the time bomb, only to find that in the end, it's we who have become the moral equivalent of the time bomb. Every ethical and religious tradition views torture as abhorrent. Since the proposed moral justification for torture as information gathering is itself morally unjustifiable, and since the other purposes of torture are plainly unacceptable, we're better off treating the prohibition of torture as morally absolute.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hilde, for your testimony. We'll now turn to Dr. Christian Davenport, who is a professor of political science at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow and director of research at the Center for International Development and Conflict Management. His research includes the relationship between democracy and human rights. Dr. Davenport, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, sir. Chairman and distinguished members of the Commission, I thank you for the invitation to testify about my research on the impact of democracy on prevention of torture in particular and human rights violations in general. I also wish to recognize the exemplary efforts of the Commission members to draw attention to the criminal act of torture in the United States, as well as the Commission's continuing effort to investigate this issue worldwide. I applaud you for the work you've done to date and will continue to do, and I'm both flattered and pleased to be able to offer some small assistance in this important endeavor here today. My testimony today draws primarily on research that I've undertaken with Professor Will Moore at Florida State University and David Armstrong at Oxford University. They'll also rely on research projects conducted by myself and others in the team and work in the broader community of scholars interested in the violation of human rights, generally and the use of torture, specifically. Several international treaties, such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Convention Against Torture, make torture legal, and while the Helsinki Final Act does not explicitly mention torture, both commit state signatories to respect human rights broadly construed and respect their international obligations under other treaties. Further, and just as important, the U.S. Constitution, of course, U.S. federal law, prohibit the use of torture by U.S. officials and their employees. Those international treaties and similar domestic laws in other nations prohibit the use of torture elsewhere throughout the world. Yet, contrary to popular understanding, the use of torture remains widespread. Existing data that's provided in the testimony I submitted to the commission roughly show that 80% of the countries of the world torture at least one individual under the government's control in any given year over the period between 1981 and 1999, the focus of our research. Indeed, the prohibition against torture is the most widely violated of the human rights to the personal integrity of the person. With that background, the shocked reaction to the revelation of the acts of inhuman and degrading treatment and torture of inmates in Abu Ghraib prison led me and my colleagues to undertake a scientific inquiry to determine whether the institutions that support liberal democracy, as popular franchise, diverse accountability mechanisms, and freedom of expression, reduce the likelihood of torture by governments during the late 20th century. The institutions that support liberal democracy are strongly associated throughout the globe with freedom, good governance, and human rights. There has been little investigation, however, the extent to which these institutions in particular reduce the use of torture. In fact, there's only one that we've identified. Our research attempted to fill this gap. I wish to share three points with you today. First, torture is distressingly common. Second, while countries with institutions that support liberal democracy do engage in torture with a considerably lower likelihood than countries that lack such institutions, this difference only holds when no groups engage in acts of violence to challenge the government or its policies. When at least one group commits at least one act of violence, countries with institutions that support liberal democracy are effectively just as likely to use torture as countries that do not have such institutions. Finally, I wish to briefly describe the extent to which each type of institution influences the likelihood of torture. I'll briefly relate each point in turn, and then close with some observations about what this research implies for those of us, like this Honorable Commission, who wish to stand vigil in defense of human rights and press governments to eschew the use of torture. It's an unpleasant truth of the human condition that torture is ordinary. Your invitation of December 3rd, 2007 asked me to address the aberration of torture in a democracy. While I do not wish to quarrel with the chairman and the members of the distinguished panel, I do wish to observe that between 81 and 1999, 80% of the world committed at least one act every year, and only 20% committed zero acts of reported torture. It is important to be clear about the definition of which these statistics are based. We referred to torture as the purposeful inflicting of extreme pain, whether mental or physical, by government officials or by private individuals at the instigation of government officials. Torture includes the use of physical other force by police and prison guards that is cruel, inhuman, or degrading. Torture can be anything from simple beatings to other practices such as rape or administering shock or electrocution as a means of getting information or a forced confession. Seen in historical perspective, torture is less common today than it has been in centuries past, and democracies are less likely to use torture as a regular interrogation practice, yet this long historical trend aside, the use of torture is common and widespread across countries with all types of institutions. Yet recent research has documented that countries with liberal democratic institutions are notably different in the type of torture they employ, more specifically as international and national monitoring of the treatment of prisoners has increased over the past century, democracies have responded by innovating clean methods of torture that do not leave permanent marks or other evidence of pain or physical trauma. Now, research demonstrates that a percentage of countries which use torture in a given year jumps from 80 to 98% when at least one group engages in one act of violence against the government in that year. Put differently, during the final two decades of the 20th century, nearly every country that was faced with a violent challenge to its rule engaged in torturous activity. Social science is less precise than we would like, of course, yet a figure like 98% jumps out at anyone, especially when one considers that governments seek to hide torture. The data we have is certainly an undercount of actual torturous activity. Thus, it is quite likely that this figure is something of an underestimate. My own research, as well as that of others, has demonstrated that liberal democratic institutions, such as the popular franchise, checks and balances, and freedom of expression, reduce violations of human rights, especially physical integrity of the person. Yet, historical research of government repression of dissidents revealed that governments in countries with democratic institutions tend to shift from overt to covert tactics to repress dissident groups. Put more directly, while democratic institutions are strongly associated with greater observance of physical integrity rights on average, their impact is seriously eroded when groups in those countries resort to violence to challenge the government and its policies. What works in decreasing torture? Well, we show that elections themselves have no impact on the likelihood that a government uses torture when dissident groups engage in violent activity. We do find that a combination of both higher voter turnout and close legislative electoral outcomes are associated with a reduced likelihood of torture given violent dissent, but only when the country has not been using torture previously. The combination of an independent judiciary and a legislature with high levels of opposition party representation reduces the likelihood of use of torture in the presence of violent dissent, though only when there has been no torture in the preceding year. Finally, while protection of the right to freedom of press strongly reduces the likelihood the government uses torture in the absence of violent dissent, that effect disappears when dissident groups undertake violent activity. Now, champions of democracy and human rights will find little cheer in the findings I discuss. Research shows that not only torture is depressingly common, that democracies have led a global shift to clean techniques that make torture harder to detect, but that institutions that define liberal democracy have little effect on the use of torture when they are most needed, when groups that oppose the government and its policies turn to violent means to press their political views on society. Government rightly has the responsibility to protect the body politic from predation by those who would tend to try to tear it asunder. Protecting citizens' right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness falls within that charge. Yet it is government more than any other human institution that deprecates the physical integrity rights of human beings, and torture is the most common offense of governments in this domain. Contemporary research exposes as fiction the notion that the institutions that are justly celebrated as the foundation of liberal democracy largely and almost completely fail to deter governments from engaging in torture when the government is challenged by violent dissent. To be sure, these institutions considerably reduce the likelihood of torture in the absence of a violent challenge to government, but that important constraint more or less evaporates in the face of violent dissident activity. Now, preliminary work suggests that it is civil society, not government institutions, that can stop torture once it has begun. Civil society tends to thrive in the absence of liberal democratic institutions, but the existence of democratic institutions alone is not sufficient. In this context, we urge the Commission to continue to reach out to non-governmental organizations as they are the primary vehicle for strengthening civil society, especially in the area of human rights. To the extent that legislators can work with activists and other citizens interested in holding government to its highest ideals, we can find cause for hope to continue down this long road we are traveling to rid the world of torture. Finally, I would like to urge the Commission to continue to reach out to the academic community in particular that is engaged in work directly relevant to the Commission's mandate. There are a great many individuals involved in research that could be useful for understanding and improving human rights conditions. Unfortunately, these efforts are frequently left within academic journals and conferences hidden behind inaccessible jargon. In short, we don't get out much, and we surely need to. If, as a member of this community, we can assist you in any way, please feel free to contact any of us in the future. I thank you very much for your attention and interest.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Our next witness will be Mr. Malcolm Wrightson Nance, who's Director of Special Readiness Services International and Director of International Anti-Terrorism Center for Excellence. Mr. Nance is a 20-year veteran of the U.S. intelligence community's Combating Terrorism Program. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, I'm honored to be here to speak to you today on an issue of great importance. My name is Malcolm Nance. I'm a 20-year veteran of the intelligence community, where I served as a cryptologist, Arabic interpreter, field interrogator, and instructor at the U.S. Navy Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape School, known as SEER. In my civilian capacity, I continue to serve as an advisor, educator, and scholar in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency intelligence. I come today as an intelligence professional with a dire warning. As I've testified before a similar hearing in the House, while at SEER, one of my most serious responsibilities was to employ, supervise, and witness dramatic and highly kinetic coercive interrogation methods, including a wide range of activities now referred to as enhanced interrogation techniques. This included hands-on, short-duration, high-intensity brutality, such as face slapping, painful stress positions, simulated sexual assault, mock executions, and the most severe, waterboarding. I have testified that waterboarding, of which I was subjected to the maximum limit allowable, is a professional process when done in the hands of a competent team. It is also an inhumane, cruel, degrading torture that was applied regularly by the most evil enemies fought by this nation's armed forces, including the Nazis and the North Vietnamese. Let us put the techniques aside. We face a crisis because of the belief in a myth. The myth that torture is effective and can gain the truth from a subject has been praised and endorsed by many of our highest citizens. In light of public opposition to torture, some members of the American intelligentsia have called for a third way regarding torture and would support it under certain conditions. Recently, no less august personality than the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard University, Alan M. Dershowitz, advocated torture. He recently and publicly stated that torture should be one of the legal tools to fight terrorism in the ticking time bomb scenario. He called for the creation of a torture warrant, whereby torture would legally be authorized to extract information critical to stopping an imminent attack. This medieval, arcane, and ignorant misimpression of what he labeled extreme measures would authorize the president to use torture and provide legal grounds to conduct brutality. In my view, it is a license to return to the Middle Ages and provide a judicial basis for a 21st century inquisition. It will create an ironclad international standard through which past and future torturers can claim innocence. By Dershowitz's hypothesis, Nazi SS officer Klaus Barbie's interrogations and tortures of French resistance members was acceptable to stop their form of terrorism. By this reading, all of Pol Pot's torture orders were justifiable. There is clearly a particular madness that the image and allure of brutalizing one's enemies afflicts those who are furthest away from the bloodshed. And believe me, I am very close to the bloodshed. These advocates of murder and brutality must be reminded in the strongest terms that the honored service of the American armed forces and intelligence community is not their play toy. Unlike the present illegal coercion and torture activities, which the administration has embraced in defiance of U.S. and international law, the activities of the SEER program were honorable demonstrations in a simulated captive environment, which inoculated our students to the experience of high-intensity stress and duress. We now learn that this historic body of torture knowledge, wrought from the pain and graves of tens of thousands of American prisoners of war, from the Revolution to Iraq and Afghanistan, was the template for Department of Defense and CIA processing of al-Qaeda prisoners. The thought that we decided to use our enemy's torture playbook is too disgusting to imagine. Torture must be banned by this nation, and we must strive to regain the moral high ground. We must call for a new Geneva Convention where the laws regarding the activities of enemy combatants and their handling of them on and off the battlefield can be reset to the lowered bar of justice. America's honor must be restored. To do that, we must embrace our cherished values as fair and decent people and hold to account those who have ordered and conducted illegal activities in our name. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Just make a quick comment. I think most of us in Congress thought we had already outlawed torture. Mm-hmm. And that not only did we make it illegal, we thought that the values of America was so ingrained in our institutions that that you would never see any systematic effort by our government to push an envelope as far as they think they could in order to use enhanced interrogation techniques in a way that, if used against us, would clearly be categorized as torture. So I think this is all very troubling that we now need to figure out a new law. And then there's a question under the president's interpretation of his constitutional power as to whether that would restrict the president anyway. Now, of course, during the attorney general's hearing, I think it became clear that the statutes need to be enforced, including the president. Ms. Javy, you mentioned the letter from the four retired attorneys, that advocate generals who work for the military. I'm going to put that letter into the record, but let me just quote one paragraph from that, because I think it is somewhat fundamental to the question we have here. It says, the rule of law is fundamental to the existence as a civilized nation. The rule of law is not a goal, which is merely aspire to achieve. It is a floor below which we must not sink. For the rule of law to function effectively, however, it must provide actual rules that can be followed. In this instance, the relative law rule has long been clear. Waterboarding detainees amounts to illegal torture in all circumstances. To suggest otherwise or even give credence to such a suggestion represents both an affront to the law and the core values of our nation. I think that's somewhat fundamental to what we are dealing with. And when the President issues these executive orders that raise question, it really causes us to be diminished as far as our basic respect for rule of law as well as the core values of our country. You mentioned the fact that the DOD, Department of Defense, and the intelligence community now have two separate rules. We have the Army manual, military manual, which is binding on our military, but the intelligence community has a different set of rules. I would like to just get your view as to how workable that is, that you could have two different types of standards, one for our military and the other for our civilian population.
Well, I think that what we have observed to this point, Mr. Chairman, is that that it's not workable, that it has created significant problems and continues to create significant problems. The acting Judge Advocates General of the Armed Forces, shortly after the issuance of the executive order, expressed concerns that this separate standard for Common Article 3 was going to make it more difficult for them to enforce humane treatment standards within the military. They also expressed concerns that this could potentially put our soldiers at greater risk if they're taken into enemy custody. So I think that there are several problems with having this double standard. It sends a confused message as to what the United States means when it says that we're upholding our international obligations to treat prisoners humanely. Luckily, Congress at this particular moment in time has the opportunity to do away with that dual standard and to make sure that all U.S. interrogators use one humane standard under the Army Field Manual, a standard that has proved effective in interrogations and a standard that requires humane treatment.
I guess what I'm concerned about is the power of the President versus the laws passed by Congress. It seems to me that when Congress passes a pretty clear law, that needs to be administered by the President. In 2002, the so-called Bybee memo, which has been subsequently disavowed by the Justice Department, but it was the opinion for a two-year period that basically said that our definition of torture would only include those types of activities that were life-threatening, and that if it wouldn't lead to physical pain amounting to torture must be equivalent in intensity to pain accompanying serious physical injury such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. Now, obviously, to all of us, I think, that's a pretty extreme view and would permit many forms of interrogation techniques that are clearly in our common understanding of torture. I guess my concern is the conflict between the power of the President to go beyond anything that Congress does versus the effectiveness of congressional statutes.
Well, I certainly share your view that the interpretation of the anti-torture statute that was contained in the Bybee memo was a pretty disingenuous interpretation of that of the standard of what is prohibited as torture. I think that, but I do, however, believe that it would be possible for Congress to further legislate to ensure that such disingenuous interpretations of statutes such as the anti-torture statute or of the McCain Amendment, of which we're afraid there is a similar memo and that the New York Times has reported there is a similar memo that is not an honest or a very straightforward interpretation of what the McCain Amendment means. But I do believe that during the confirmation process, now Attorney General Mukasey stated that if Congress passed legislation that made the Army Field Manual the standard, sole single standard for U.S. interrogations, that he would enforce it. And that gives me hope that should Congress act and pass this law, and should this act not be vetoed by the President, or if Congress is able to overcome a veto, that the Justice Department will take the position that this law, which would limit what type of interrogation techniques interrogators can use, is constitutional and would enforce it.
He clearly did say that during the confirmation process, but then left room for interpretation of any technique based upon the potential power of the President to exercise his authority. So I am comforted by some of his statements, but overall on torture, I did not feel comfortable with a commitment really to have an absolute standard as set by Congress. Let me turn, if I might, to the justification used by many to say why we have to use torture, and that is the ticking bomb. Several of you talked about the ticking bomb scenario, where you're confronted with a desperate situation where information is vital in order to protect the safety of the people of our community, and you have someone in custody who perhaps has that information, and you don't have the time to go through the niceties. So why not just use methods that can solicit at least some information in a timely fashion? Why not allow, under extreme circumstances as determined by whether it's the torture warrant, I think you suggested, perhaps a court makes that judgment, perhaps the President, why not permit torture under those circumstances? Nancy, wanna?
Well, it's quite simple. As Professor Dershowitz recommended, the torture warrant, it's laughable on its face, in the sense that in counterterrorism, you are constantly facing the ticking time bomb. You're talking about an asymmetric threat of people who are in a constant state of planning, readiness, and going through an operational cycle to deploy weapons systems or terrorist systems or activities of which you would consider imminent at all times. If that were the case, there would have been large-scale and widespread torture more than there was in Northern Ireland with the British throughout the 1970s and 1980s, because they were under constant IRA bombing threat, which means that every individual that you would get into your custody would be a potential imminent ticking time bomb threat candidate for a torture warrant.
Yeah, I agree. I think by definition, we wouldn't have the people under interrogation unless there was some information that was critically important for us to have in order to avoid a disaster. We never know exactly when bombs are going to go off, so I guess they're always ticking. Dr. Hilde, did you want to comment further on that?
Well, the International Red Cross did mention at one point that they considered 90% of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison to be innocent. So if we're involved in seeking a ticking time bomb moral justification to torture individual human beings, and we're all of a sudden discovering that 90% of the people in custody are actually innocent, I think we're faced with only finding ex post facto justifications, morally speaking, which should come prior to the actual torture. And that may never be the actual dramatic version of the ticking time bomb, but rather something along the lines of where is a weapons cache? where is an IED? Do we wish to allow torture to be institutionalized in order to find this sort of daily information? There is definitely a tragic decision to be made there, but the ticking time bomb example takes it all out of proportion. It's usually torturing the one versus saving the city of New York. And that's a terribly poor basis for a moral argument.
Clearly, and of course, the ticking time bomb definition is subjected to a great deal of abuse, as Mr. Nance has pointed out. And let me just put in the record a quote from the Pentagon Working Group memo of 2003. Army interrogation experts view the use of force as an inferior technique that yields information of questionable quality. So that if you really are confronted with a very time-sensitive episode, you may very well find that by using torture, you're going to waste the valuable time that you do have by tracking down information that's not reliable in the first place. So there's a question of reliability as well as one of definition, in addition to the moral issues and the legal issues that many of you have raised. Dr. Davenport, do you want to comment on that?
Well, in part to kind of step away from the ticking time bomb for a second and think more of more mundane aspects of it as well. So if you look at, there's an organization called Relatives for Justice in West Belfast that documents kind of everyday experience of people in Northern Ireland. And yes, there was a certain periods where there was a constant threat, but then this did not explain the kind of rather broad net that was cast across much of the Catholic community to kind of prosecute them in a certain way and intimidate them. So torture had a different effect. You weren't trying to elicit information in that context. You were trying to intimidate. So I think we kind of forget that sometimes. And I think also the law enforcement applications we also kind of forget as well, because we focus on the military context. We forget that just a lot of kind of mundane aspects of law enforcement. I'm from New York, so Amadou Diallo, I think there's many instances of torture that have taken place with regards to just like law enforcement scenarios that tend to get forgotten because of this highly politicized dealing with terrorist organizations or civil war context. We just have kind of everyday life as well.
Dr. Davenport, your numbers are very, very troubling as to the number of countries that have condoned the use of torture, particularly those that share common values that we have been trying to provide international leadership. We talk about our Western values, we talk about our American values, we talk about countries that share those values in many of our policies, international policies, foreign policy, our foreign aid budget. So much of it is based upon trying to be a leader on Western values. And yet your statistics indicate that many of our countries would condone the use of torture. And then you take a look at some of the public opinion polls, and it's mixed. It's not as strong as many of us would like to see in condemning the use of torture. Could you just give me a little bit more information about how you conducted that research? As you say, when torture is used, countries don't issue press releases. How did you do your research there?
Interestingly enough, particular project, the paper that I reported here was drawn from State Department country reports and Amnesty International and other sources that basically try to catalog this as best they can from human rights organizations quite frequently on the ground. So yes, there's no press release, but the victims are occasionally tapped by human rights organizations on the ground that then kind of in turn provide that information. This is also consistent though with there's a book that I just had come out called State Repression and the Domestic Democratic Peace, which also shows kind of something very similar in the sense that not all aspects of democracy are equally important for reducing human rights violations. So to that extent, the way we've kind of broadly cast our conception of what we think of as democratizing or the most important institutions and bringing about that reduction in human rights is not as consistent as we would like. So there's certain aspects of it. The electoral dimension is not as important as the development of civil society, is not as important as electoral competition, having diversified parties as well.
I'm going to turn to Chairman Hastings, and I will return with a few other questions.
Thank you very much, Senator. I have perhaps more questions than answers, but I would offer All of us can be creative with scenarios, I'm sure. And the ticking time bomb, I'm in thorough agreement with Mr. Nance. On an earlier conversation he and I had, he said that there may be circumstances where the individuals who would use extraordinary measures to try to exact information might very well put themselves in the position of saying, fine, I have to do this, I'm going to break the law and suffer the consequences. The likelihood is that a lot of enlightened people would do that, and in the comfort of this fine room here at the University of Maryland, we might easily underscore that. I'd also like to point, Dr. Nance, Mr. Nance and I are meeting personally for the first time today, but I would like to point to his book, because he has an experience that I think many of us do not have, and his book is The Terrorists of Iraq. And in his opening line, he cites to the fact that this came at the expense of six colleagues of his that died, giving rise to his writing this. He also, and I didn't say this to him earlier, has remained professional and obscure until certain things have set him off, and he remains professional but decided to begin putting forth some information based on experience. Now, what if we got a call and one of the aides came up to Senator Cardin and said they just caught a guy at the Hyattsville County Courthouse that says that he planted a dirty bomb at the student union at the University of Maryland. And that bomb's scheduled to go off in 30 minutes and they have him in custody. The question would be, could you do anything to get information out of him, or what price would we be willing to pay in order to get that information out of him? I don't think that there's an answer to it, but I just throw it out there because I can see the situation in the life of those of you that are young people with the really clear and present dangers that are extant in the world today, that the likelihood is a day will occur somewhere in the world where someone will have information about the potential destruction of a city. And it will be interesting to see. We can sit up here and theorize and carry on about different scenarios until we're blue in the face. But when you're on the ground and have to discharge this function, it takes on a different characteristic. Let me carry forth further the notion of something that is disturbing to me. I was in the conference, as I said to Ms. Chaffee, when Senator Feinstein last week, Senator Cardin, offered the measure that would bring the Central Intelligence Agency under the norms of military interrogation, and it passed out of the conference. The conference occurs when the two committees get together and conform a measure. This was the Intelligence Authorization Act, which we have not had an authorization act in the last 3 years, really five, and this particular one has now passed the measure, awaiting final passage of the conference report itself. And then the president has indicated that he will veto that measure. Largely, there may be other measures that he and his functionaries are dissatisfied with, but one of the reasons highlighted is that it would bring this norm to our operatives in the military and in the CIA or the intelligence community, which makes an awful lot of sense to me. Now then, the president has said that alternative interrogation techniques, and we presume that this includes waterboarding, has produced good
intelligence. The question that I would put to the president is, did it also produce bad intelligence? And you can isolate or cherry pick, but the thing that would be interesting to me is the man seated here, Mr. Nance, has spent 20 years in this field. He has, if I'm not mistaken, and you correct me, Mr. Nance, he testified here that in his personal training, he was waterboarded. In addition to the fact, I believe he, based on recent reports in a forum on NewsHour, commented on about this particular technique and others. Perhaps it would have been wise for a President Bush or a Vice President Cheney or Director Hayden or any damn body to ask somebody that did it or had it done to them what it's like. But I guarantee you they didn't pick the telephone up. We did. Our staff picked the telephone up and called the gentleman, and he's seated here, and he's just one. I imagine there may be others that have had this experience. So, Mr. Nance, what do you think about extracting actionable intelligence? And tell us, so as how at least this audience will know what waterboarding is how it's performed. And toward that end, what would be your comment on the president's assertion that good intelligence has been achieved by alternative interrogation techniques? I apologize for going on that, Senator, but I wanted to get my anti-Bush digs in. You ain't like me.
I'm not here to get anti-Bush digs in. I'm here to hopefully represent the intelligence professionals out there who want to do this job right. You presented an interesting scenario, and as you were presenting that scenario about the potential attack on the student union, my mind went through a whole series of data points. My first thought was it would be a domestic terrorist because no one who was international would attack such a small target. He would bring a dirty bomb, and he would brag about the dirty bomb because he's part of a plot which perhaps doesn't even have the system. An entire intelligence process goes through the mind, not just of myself, but of everyone in my community, and a fusion of resources would be brought to bear to determine whether that plot is true or not. Now, I haven't hit anybody yet, and I didn't have to get to a baseline of information to determine the viability of that attack. Forensically, we don't operate in such a way that allows us to bring all of the resources of the intelligence community to bear. I personally believe that the intelligence community is operating on stereotype and mythology. The new operatives that are coming into the field or operators that are coming into the field are viewing TV shows like 24 as a documentary. This is not the way we do business. The true professionals in this field want to get actionable intelligence through a wide historical basis of knowledge, which comes from scholarly works, which comes from the lessons learned for, you know, over two centuries of intelligence collection and our allies. We do not have to descend to the level of our enemies. In saying that, I'll describe a little bit of what happens when you descend to the level of your enemies. The information that you get from waterboarding, let's take waterboarding because there are far worse tortures, you're going to get information. I can make anyone talk. It's as simple as that. The process, you cannot resist it. You cannot not say something because your lungs are filling with water and you feel every drop as they enter. The pressure, the way that the technique is performed, and you might have seen some of it on video, on the internet, that is not the real waterboarding. That is what we call a field expedient amateur hour. Real waterboarding is exceptionally professional. It is done so fast that you don't know it's happening until you've already been hit with the water and you've already got a quantity of water going into your system, and it gives you a dilemma. And the dilemma that occurs to you as you're trying to spit up, gag, and choke on the water and get it out of your system, which is already pushing through into your lungs, the dilemma is, am I going to listen to this man's question and answer it? Just because you've already gone past your gag reflex and you know that you're drowning, there's nothing simulated about it, it's just controlled drowning, you will answer the question. What comes out of your mouth can be a lie, it can be a truth, it can be a half-truth. We won't know until we evaluate that. However, you're going to say something. Usually we give you an opportunity to comply nonverbally by kicking your shoes together because you can't move anything else. And after we allow you to go through a period of hysterics where you fully understand exactly what's happening to you, only then do we give you an opportunity to answer a question, often yes or no questions, because we don't want to interrupt the process. So this is the same procedure that our government intelligence agencies are using because it came from the military survival evasion resistance and escape world, and that came from our enemies. So you will talk. What you will say will be considered completely and totally unreliable until an entire, the entire $50 billion per year has been applied against whatever has come out of your mouth. Now, a good resistor or someone who has learned that you want very specific things and you want to push them away from that area will give you something that will stop the process and will allow you to maybe take a week or two to determine that it's worthless. Maybe something that you know they already know about because you read in the newspapers. I take the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed discussing the Brooklyn Bridge, cutting the cables on the Brooklyn Bridge plot. This is a very brilliant man. I know his operational methodology in the field. I understand his mindset. He's very intelligent. He went to the University of North Carolina, I believe. He would have just gotten someone from the Al-Qaeda maintenance garage with a blowtorch and would have carried out an experiment to see how long it would take to cut the cable. But knowing that it was a ridiculous plan from the outset, even though people were deployed to collect intelligence, under torture, a good resistor, someone who has gone through the process several times, would have thrown that out. And it would have stopped the process for several months, if not for some time, until they figured out that it was a worthless piece of intelligence. But he gave them something. And what we've done is we've created an operative who now knows how to work the waterboard or whatever techniques that we're using against him. We've created a hardcore resistor. Now, throughout everything that he's given us, we may never have heard some of the more ridiculous ideas that were presented at the Al-Qaeda Military Council's meetings. And he can throw out every ridiculous, rejected plan that was given to him between 1993 and 2002. And we would think it's gold, when in fact to him, it is pure trash. And it keeps him away from discussing real plans, which may actually be in effect.
Yeah. That's a very good analysis. Senator, I'd like to put one other thing on the record, and maybe, Ms. Chafee, you would respond. While we're in agreement that it is important that there be norms applied by all agencies seeking to extract information, do you perceive that if we use rendition and carry individuals to other countries where the likelihood is that they would be tortured, or that we are doing nothing more than what would amount to an artifice to get around law, assuming the president even signed this into law? And then I find abhorrent that we have black sites. And here again is a situation where it just by its name, if you name it a black site, you don't want someone to know where it is. I'm going to start naming some of these things white sites, but I try not to do that. But all things considered, it's something bad. So what's your reaction to the circumvention of the law, or do you perceive that that is circumvention of the law? And I'd invite anybody else to comment if they saw fit. And thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I think that as an organization, Human Rights First, and as an attorney there, I'm very concerned with the practices that you mentioned. The practice of extraordinary rendition, which we know has occurred. This is the practice of rendering individuals to countries for the purpose of interrogation. And We know that the United States, that the CIA has rendered individuals to countries that we know do engage in abuse, that do engage in torture, that the U.S. State Department has reported engage in torture. Under the U.N. Convention Against Torture, we have an obligation not to return individuals to countries where there is a likely chance that they will be tortured. And in rendering individuals to countries where they are likely to be tortured, we are violating our obligations under that convention. And we know that there have been individuals, Maher Arar, who testified before the House, I believe a couple of weeks ago, was in fact rendered by the CIA to Syria, where he was, in fact, we know now, abused and tortured. This is certainly a concerning practice, and one that should be that should cease. That should we know that the types of diplomatic assurances that are given by countries that engage in torture. A country simply saying yes, agreeing that they will not torture in this instance is not a reliable mechanism to make sure that our treaty obligations under the Convention Against Torture are enforced. You also mentioned the practice of secret detention. We know that there have in the past and are potentially now black sites where the CIA is detaining individuals. Secret detention. The practice of holding people incommunicado has historically been, it creates the environment that leads to abuses such as torture because there's no transparency. International Committee of the Red Cross is denied access to these sites, and so there's no way to verify that that individuals held in these sites are not being abused. And this is particularly problematic and concerning in a practice that we certainly think should no longer be engaged in.
As I listened to your responses, and Mr. Nance, as you were describing waterboarding, it raises the question I think that Ms. Chafee also acknowledged, and that is if Congress tries to be specific in defining what torture is, that you can always find a different way to do that particular procedure and claim that it is no longer under the definition of torture as passed by Congress and required by the circumstances to use that type of technique. I do think we all understand what torture is. The Supreme Court tried to do it by definition of shock to conscience. And I mean, I think Congress was pretty clear that it wanted to prohibit all these related practices. I have just a general question, if I might, and that is, this country, America, has had a proud record in promoting human rights and democracy. After World War II, we were involved in making sure those who committed war crimes were held accountable. It was the first time ever that we tried to do this internationally to say that there are certain crimes against humanity in which people are going to be held, including government officials acting under the authority of government, were going to be held accountable for their activities internationally. And then during the Cold War, we established a way in which the international community understood that what was happening in other countries with the failure of allowing free elections and not allowing people the right to speak out, we were going to stand up for basic human rights, and we spent a lot of time international leadership to make it clear that if a country wanted to become a democratic country, there were certain responsibilities in accomplishing that. And then we exercised tremendous leadership to bring down the apartheid government of South Africa. One of the proudest moments, I think, of the United States, when we figured out a way to really bring that to the forefront. And then more recently, in former Yugoslavia, we were the ones who spoke up and said, yes, it is legitimate for us to interfere to protect against ethnic cleansing and protect human rights. And just recently, in the work in our commission on dealing with trafficking and dealing with all forms of discrimination, the United States has exercised tremendous leadership. These are our values. So where do we go? How did this come about? How could democratic countries say that torture can be done by us, but not by our enemies, because our values are consistent with the use of torture? How could that happen? Where are our vulnerabilities? In order to try to correct this, how did this come about?
If I can, I can speak from the, as I like to say, from the deck plates first. I was at the Pentagon. I actually was outside the Pentagon on the morning of September 11th. I saw the aircraft hit the building. I drove right to the site and assisted in the rescue. I know what the stakes are in this operation. I knew exactly who had done it, how it was done, and the entire corporate history behind Al-Qaeda for wanting to do it. This, for some strange reason, the morning of September 11th seemed to, in some hands, create an ideological door jam, so to speak, to where those fantasies that I talk about of what people think the intelligence community should be doing and could do, which I call, we actually refer amongst ourselves as Tom Clancy combat procedures. Okay? CPP. These are not the way the community truly works. Now, and some people also saw this as an opportunity to go back before the Church Commission and restore the intelligence communities into its do whatever you want with impunity above the law standard. Now, I view it a different way. I've been called a Boy Scout in this respect, and I guess I am. Since we did not fight evil in World War II in order to become the greatest human rights abuser since the communists or since the Cambodians and the greatest torture nation and subcontractor of torture. September 11th didn't allow us to destroy our values or the Constitution. And there are many within the community that believe this. However, when you literally write an executive order or a rule that allows you to do whatever it takes, there are many people within the system who will do whatever it takes and view that as, and be rewarded for doing that. And it's as simple as that. It's as simple as having permission to essentially descend down to the level of a torture state, or no, to a certain extent, no better than the Argentinians during the Dirty War.
I have a somewhat different kind of response to your question. It seems as if, historically, democracy has been very good at eliminating the most egregious and the most obvious forms of state abuse towards its citizens. And with increased accountability comes an increased desire to hide your abuses, which would lead directly to greater torture. So, in a sense, it's a different correlation than we'd like. But through promoting democracy, we've kind of shifted the plane. I mean, we haven't necessarily eliminated the problem of order. We've shifted the way in which most states will engage in it, and we've kind of prompted individuals to engage in the more hidden forms of repressive activities that are harder to detect, are perhaps the most persistent historically in many respects. And so I think that kind of speaks to the paradox you rose.
Can I ask a question, Senator? Dr. Hilde, you commented in your paper on the theory that the sole conceivable rationale for torture and liberal ideology is, I believe you say, information or gathering to prevent a catastrophe. This is certainly a prominent element of public debate, and one that underpins what we have constantly today talked about, the ticking time bomb scenario. But at the same time, there have been some government officials, for example, former Attorney General Gonzalez, in a press conference in 2004, expressed the view that we should not reveal to our enemies what our interrogation techniques are and how far we're willing to go. What do you make of that concern, and what does that say about what the impetus for harsh interrogation has been?
Well, first of all, there's no good moral argument for torture. The only one that does exist is this hypothetical, which I think is outrageous anyway. Extremely rare, probably non-existent, and nonetheless outrageous. And in that scenario, yes, perhaps one is faced with a moral tragedy, but it ought to be illegal. So if one does torture in order to gain the ticking time bomb, they ought to be held under the law regardless. And Mr. Nance and I discussed this earlier. I think we're in agreement on this. As for the statement that our enemies ought not to know what we're capable of, That's a difficult question. Yes, I would suppose that if enemies knew precisely what the interrogation practices are, they could much more easily train themselves to avoid giving true information during those interrogation practices. And perhaps the threat of extreme forms of torture is enough to frighten some prisoners into providing information without torture even having to be applied. Yet the incentive is going to be that, it, at least in some cases, that an organization which is based upon this idea is going to have to show examples to people that these practices are engaged in. And that would be the only effective way to create this disincentive.
I understand. Doctor, to regress with respect to torture, especially with respect to what you call violence, you would elaborate just a little bit on what you mean when you talk about violent dissent, insofar as your research demonstrated. Can you elaborate on what effect those same circumstances have on other human rights? And that is, do you see an effect of violent dissent on, say, free speech or democratic governance or free elections?
By violent dissent, generally focusing on civil war and insurgency, specific acts of terrorism that involve destruction of property and individuals. We're in the process now of actually going through and trying to assess which rights and which personal integrity violations are most threatened by this. In my book, I identify that that the predominant influences of democracy are most effective at eliminating or reducing physical integrity violations. So, mass killing, imprisonment, torture, disappearances, and less effective with regards to speech, association, and so forth. So those are the most vulnerable within the context of domestic threats. What I refer to as the domestic democratic peace, the ability of different institutions of democracy to reduce human rights violations, is least effective at trying to counter political violence and conflict situations for the less violent ones, the less the more sensitized ones, in a sense. So speech and association are the ones most vulnerable when we're fighting violent dissident activities, when the state is fighting violent dissident activities. Those are the things that are most threatened.
Since you and your colleagues did your research and now are published, at least in academia, has that brought further attention worldwide to the empirical data gathering information that you're doing?
In my opinion, no. Part of the difficulty is, I think, the community has been distracted by discussions about civil war and terrorism and the ramifications of human rights, and the effectiveness of democracy in improving this situation has not necessarily been as thoroughly investigated as we would like.
In your data compilation, did you eventually come to conclusions at this point in the 80%, for example, of the countries that, as I recall, you said, permitted torture at least once during a specified period of time? Did you come to a determination as to numerically which were the worst offenders and which were the least offenders?
One could, with our analysis, do that. It's one of those kind of cultural things. In academia, where the naming and shaming element of exactly what we do is kind of antithetical in many respects to what people would like to know. But
we all need a good dose of politics.
Exactly. But very easily we could identify the ranking of who are the worst and who are the best conditions. We'd also like to try to expand it to try to think of not just that torture takes place, but also the scope throughout the population, and get a general sense of exactly how many people are being implicated.
Thank you, sir. Of course, the United States State Department does make certain lists, so these lists are available. I don't believe they include the United States.
That was just what I said.
Review, but they do make these lists available, and they do quantitate in different areas. And Congress has passed statutes to require certain types of reports to be made available just for the purpose that you've said, and that is to put a spotlight on these countries. We're lobbied frequently by other countries to get off those lists. We tell them how they can do it. So it serves a very useful purpose, and I think your information would be very helpful to all of us. I want to thank all the witnesses for your testimony.
Indeed.
I found it extremely helpful. We have a challenge. We have a challenge. Yes, it is possible that Congress will have to clarify the laws, but we also need leadership to make it clear that our values are to be complied with. We're not looking for ways to get around the statutes, but the way to make our commitment against torture meaningful for other countries to follow. And we don't have that today. In order to accomplish that, we do need better public understanding. I don't think the public truly understands the depth of the issues concerning techniques of interrogation and torture and how it's used. And to that end, I think each of you have really added to the national discussion and debate. And I thank each of you in your own way by being here, not only by being here, but by your roles in the publications that you're issuing, the public, the responsibility you've taken in visiting the various places, and Mr. Nance, with your experience and being willing to help in the public discussion here, I found extremely helpful. At the end of the day, if we have, as I think we should, a zero tolerance on torture, which should be the not only the law of this country, but the principles of our country, we're going to be a safer country. We're going to be a safer country as far as public safety, and we're going to be a safer country as far as civil liberties are concerned. And that's really what the values of America should be directed towards. So I thank you again for your testimony today. I thank the chairman for allowing
thank
us to
sir.
Have this field hearing in College Park. Once again, Dr. Mote, thank you for making the arrangements, and this hearing will stand adjourned.
Thank you, Senator.